This is Russ Burlingame and Zach Roberts on the Emerald City Video Podcast, and we're talking to whoever's listening out there.
Breaker, breaker.
this is the episode where we're going to talk a little bit about Big Trouble in Little China and Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Right now, Zach and I have just finished watching Big Trouble in Little China myself for the first time.
Yes, I think I've seen it probably 212 times, since I'm pretty sure I first watched it on Betamax.
So that's more than me, then.
Yeah, quite so.
Also, this is the first time that we've intentionally and with equipment recorded an Emerald City podcast in one room together.
Yes.
Like, we have had a couple of episodes where we were just kind of drunkenly set the phone down and hit record, but not even necessarily literally drunk, mostly just like punch drunk from watching a movie at 2 a.m. and then going home to bitch about Suicide Squad.
Oh, God.
But yeah, so first of all, you having seen it before, how did it age for you?
I actually watched it when we first started talking about this idea of the comparison. I watched it like a week ago, I think, and yeah, I still love it. It's still one of my favorite films. I mean, John Carpenter is fantastic, and yeah, I mean, it's The Escape from New York and L.A. Both of those films I love. Basically, anything with John Carpenter and Kurt Russell is great. So.
Yeah, I dug the hell out of it. It's a weird movie. Like, we talked a lot while it was on about the fact that, like, they're remaking this film.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine exactly how that's going to work, because so much of it feels like it's driven by, like, 80s cinema.
Yeah, it's hard to remember, because I was probably 7 when I first saw this film.
Yeah.
It's hard to remember, like, what was okay and what wasn't, because, I mean, obviously there's a lot of racial issues with this film that I don't know if they'll be able to get away with. I mean, maybe the right director will be able to do something, but, like, there'll inevitably be some level of outrage factory will happen just because of the title and I'm sure that, you know. And no doubt that they'll, because they still have the issue with Asian actors being able to even start creating stars, you know? Yeah. I mean, we're talking about Daniel Wu from Into the Badland, I think would be a great... He may be too old, though, because he's actually, like... I think he's actually, like, 40. And, like, one of the things in this film is that they seem to be relatively young characters, though I don't know if that has really anything to do with anything.
Yeah, I mean...
Like, I feel like... I mean, The Rock, if they're doing The Rock, God forbid... which, again, like, as we keep saying, there's nothing at all wrong with The Rock.
No,
I just don't think that in any way, shape, and form he's Jack Burton.
No, it doesn't feel... anyway. But here's my thing. I can totally see, because of how Hollywood works, I could totally see them having the random monk from Rogue One.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, hey, if you need an Asian character... There's one guy who was in a billion-dollar movie last year, so let's use him.
Yeah, Star Wars. He can be the Star Wars. He'd actually be great for the, which I feel bad, I forget the actor's name, the older magic.
Oh, yeah.
Damn it. Who is it?
Lohan?
The good guy.
Egg Shen.
Yeah, Egg Shen. which, again, there's so many issues with this film that's like, again, 80 films were able to get away with, like, I don't know if they were able to get away with it or not, or whether they still can, but you kind of give it a nod because there is a certain level of, like, camp, and there's a level of the nod to the Hong Kong cinema, which the Hong Kong cinema was, like, horrible. I mean, making fun of themselves and, you know, in every way, shape, and form, and whether or not... You know, though I think James Gunn would, if only James Gunn could get attached to this film, because that would, I think that he can actually, because he knows the camp and you know, that's where he came from.
I don't know if they have a director yet. I'm not going to look it up right now, but that's actually, even accepting James Gunn from the conversation, like, taking somebody who got their start in like trauma would be a good place to start with this, because like they know low budget and they know camp and they kind of know what they can get away with that looks like shit. Because like there was a good chunk of this movie that just looked like shit.
Yeah.
But it was like, no, but you can get away with it because of the way this movie is. Yeah. And
but the, I mean, one of the things is though that it a lot of it it's like all of Carpenter's films really. I mean, at least there was that break in like the late 90s when everything kind of went to hell. I blame James Woods. But that vampire film. That was kind of his last even almost decent film, I hate to say, and I love John Carpenter. There was this level of, it looked like that last scene we were talking about with the neon lights stringing around stringing around this skull, and it looks incredible. And I'm sure if you turn on all the lights, it would look horrible because he's, I mean, whoever his lighting people were and all the things that were able to do things on such the cheap level and make them look good, you know, I mean, like make them look, they're real within the world that the film is set in, and which is always the most important thing. Like if they do this film with CG and green screens, it's going to be horrible.
I you know what would be. And this will never, ever happen just because of rights issues and Carpenter and blah, blah, blah. Like, this would be great as one of those, like, the live shows, like, basically the filmed stage shows that, like, ABC does all the time.
You want a Big Trouble in Little China musical? Is that what you want? Oh, God, what are they, are they doing? I'm trying to remember what film they're doing one that's unbelievable. Anyway, but
I can't remember. I lost track of them very, very quickly.
Now that everything has to become a musical eventually, unless it's first a musical, then I'm sure Hamilton is currently being produced.
It's got
to
be.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be. But anyway.
But yeah, and I guess the elephant in the room in terms of this podcast.
Oh, it's Groundhog's Day.
Is a musical. Yeah, that's right. You're right. Which just strikes me as such a strange decision, because, like, wouldn't it just be the same songs over and over again?
It actually is one of the big... of course there was an NPR interview about it. It was, like, 30 minutes long when they're talking to the producers, because, anyway, but yeah, you were saying, sorry.
the elephant in the room in terms of this, like, this podcast is the fact that... And we can't find a place where James Gunn has actually said that Jack Burton served as an inspiration for Peter Quill. But in the course of trying to find such a record, we did find a couple of interviews where, like...
Everybody's talking
about it. Everybody talks about the fact that it's out there. And, like, nobody's ever... We can't find any of the actors saying, oh, yeah, James told us that. Yeah. Or, oh, yeah, I thought that when I read the script. But you do see all these people who talk about the fact that the internet is talking about that.
Yeah.
And, like, you see, there's an interview with Kurt Russell, because he's going to play... he plays... Peter Quill's father in Guardians 2, which of course then leads itself to the joke that Jack Burton is Peter Quill's father.
Yeah. Which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. But I want to say Screen Rant asked him outright during the interview, like, has James talked to you about this? And his response was something along the lines of that when he watched the first Guardians of the Galaxy with his wife, it was... Like, he saw a bunch of little things, and he's, like, reading between the lines. And, like, one of the things that you pointed out in the last, 5-10 minutes of it.
There's Jack Burton. Who?
Exactly. which, I'd be curious, like, if the internet existed in, you know... First of all, if the internet existed when this movie first came out, I feel like this movie would have had a sequel.
Yeah.
Because they just... Yeah. It would have been memed to death.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if the I'm Jack Burton who would have become the Star Lord who meme.
But it's although I wonder has Carpenter ever done a sequel? Escape.
Yeah.
Which, but on the other hand, we as much as I as much as I have expressed and continue to love Escape from L.A.
I feel like he has to. I mean, God knows. He probably hasn't directed a sequel, but there's probably been sequels based on his stuff. Obviously, The Thing is like a remake of a remake of something else that is also not called The Thing. So it's like a weird, like, I do know that he has a weird, like, he has a lot of, Halloween.
Oh,
I don't think he did any of the sequels.
Yeah.
But yeah, I forgot he was the creator of the Halloween franchise, and
yeah.
But what was it? He does retain a lot of creative control over many of his films. So there's actually a Snake Plissken, Jack Burton comic book crossover that just it was a 6-issue miniseries. It just recently came to an end, so I'm sure there'll be a paperback out soon.
I saw that. It looks interesting.
And you know, there are like there's Escape from New York comics, and there's Big Trouble in Little China comics that are like executive produced by Carpenter. Like, I think that the Big Trouble in Little China comics, he has a like some kind of creative consultant role on where he actually talks to the writers regularly.
Yeah.
But on the Escape comics, he just kind of gives it his tacit stamp of approval, or vice versa. I can't remember which is which.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's actively involved with one of those franchises in the comic books, and less actively involved with the other franchise, but he's still got like his name is on it, and he's like he's the one who has to license it out. Clearly he has good deals with some studios that most directors wouldn't get.
Yeah, this we're gonna have to try to reach out to James Gunn and because I really do want an answer on if and any level of the inspiration there, or even Chris Pratt for that matter, whether because obviously some of it's the dialogue, but some of it's the general swagger because I mean obviously the comparison that almost everybody makes is the Harrison Ford, which is obviously there. I mean there's almost no just the way that he his clothing design to some level, but there's no way that there just can't be a way that he's not at least some level inspired by Kurt Russell in general, even Kurt Russell's characters from the 80s in the Carpenter films, because they're so the everyman, but with such a twist on it, because it's not even like Bruce Willis's action hero everyman, where he kind of goes a little bit beyond the normal what a man could go to. I mean, like in Big Trouble,
There's the moment where he like shoots into the air to scare the bad guys, and he like knocks the bricks down and knocks himself out.
Yeah, it's a little bit more like complete and real everyman.
Yeah, well we talked about that. Yeah. We not with Burton, but with the guy who played Wang.
Yeah,
there's a scene where Wang like stops to fight instead of running away.
Yeah.
And just gets like thrown around for most of the scene.
Oh, the scene where they have this great shot where. I don't know if we're talking about the same scene or a different one, but shot. I think they've taken the potion, so they have some level powers.
The one I was thinking of was before
it. Oh, okay. One of my favorite scenes in the film is the scene where they keep the camera outside of the doorway, and you just see the two being thrown back and forth with the.
No, I can't remember what it was. It was relatively early, the scene I was thinking of, and I turned to you and I said something along the lines of, you know, the difference between this movie and like the Die Hard movies is that Die Hard is like the fantasy that like the everyday person thinks that like they can do this, and whereas like this scene of him just getting like thrown around and knocked through garbage cans and shit, it's like this is what would happen if like a regular person tried to take on like
someone quite a bit more well armed.
It is like the actual everyday hero as opposed to the kind of idealized everyday hero.
I mean, like a random New York cop being able to take on 14 highly trained military
including one guy from Big Trouble in Little China.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, who eats the Snickers bar, which is there how everybody was born. I wonder how much cash they made from that one product.
Yeah.
Because it was real obvious in that film. It was like, ooh.
You know, it's funny because I always wonder, like, you know, product placement is such a thing now. And obviously it's been a thing for a while. You think back to, like, E.T.
Yeah.
Where it was basically responsible for building the Reese's Pieces. Like,
thank Lord.
Yeah.
Because I love Reese's Pieces.
So do I. But it's been a thing for a while, but I'm curious as to how things like that, how much of certain things are actually product placement. There was they got cut off by a truck here that was Puma shoes. You know,
that was so obvious that it had to have been.
I feel like it had to.
Because, I mean, most of the time, I mean, obviously probably less so back then and more than now, but I mean, like, I've heard enough stories from producers that just happen to have something, and Coca-Cola or whoever was like, no, you can't use that. And it's like, oh, well, it exists in the real world. you can't use it. I mean, you also see on TV, you know, even on all the reality shows, if some guy's wearing a shirt that has a Nike swoosh, they blur it out.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, whether or not that's the, well, screw you, we're not going to give you free advertisement and we're going to blur it out, or Nike going, yeah, I don't want to be advertised with Kim Kardashian. Thank you very much.
And so one of the other things that we were talking about is the aesthetic of this movie is so kind of weird and cool, but it reminded me so much of, like, a Generation 1, like, Nintendo, Super Nintendo video game.
Oh, yeah.
And we talked about the fact that, like, early on, you get the guys with, the traditional Chinese garb and, like, the straw hats or whatever those things are called.
Yeah.
And they're shooting the lightning that very much looks like lightning and not Mortal generic. Kombat, like, yeah. So I was like, wow, that's Raiden from Mortal Kombat. And then a little while later, like, towards the end of the movie, the guy, I don't know the name of the character, the guy who eventually blew up, like, got all fat and blew, literally blew up, when he was fighting Wang, he was wearing, like, a Chinese military uniform with a formal cape.
Yeah.
And, like, he twirls around to, like, go take a swing at him, and I'm like, wow, he just really, it's like M. Bison from Street Fighter. Yeah. I feel like at some point the video game developers of America collectively decided, like, yeah, we're gonna...
Well, no, I guess it would have been the other way around, because I was just thinking, like, I had my Nintendo in 86 or 87.
Yeah, I can't remember.
But that wasn't until Super Nintendo that those games really came out. Because, the first Nintendo did not even have the graphic displayed.
No, not really.
Able to do even that. Because Street Fighter was one of my favorites. But, it's interesting how they're going to, and, you know, I wish we could not talk about the impending remake, reboot, whatever it is. It's going to be interesting how they're able to, if they're going to drop this into modern times, whether they're going to basically do, a remake, or whether they're going to do the reboot like Ghostbusters. Cause we were talking about this before, where Ghostbusters is so separated that, you know, you can pretty much enjoy the film without it, you know, ruining, and I'm putting up my fingers in quotes, the originals. And I enjoyed the remake enough. I mean, I thought there was just some crappy writing compared to the first one. And everyone acting is perfectly fine. The story was fine enough. But it'll be interesting on whether they try to bring it back to the 80s or not, because we were talking about just things like Jack Burton's hair, Kurt Russell's hair in this. It's like, which is such a part of it. It's part of his character.
How are we going to do the hair with The Rock? Which I think actually that would be the thing that probably tips off, like, oh, it's got to be in the modern day and it's just going to be a different, because like
no one had a shaved head in, like, an actually shaved head in the 80s. Somebody can post if I'm completely wrong, but I can't remember any actors that wasn't, Kojak, maybe. Like,
yeah.
But that was, like, literally he was distinctive because he had
exactly.
That. Like,
because like, nobody... that's why we literally called people who had that hairstyle Kojak.
Yeah, or... we should try not to talk about what might happen and because this it's too worrying to think about. Not that, again, I just, if a trailer comes out and it just looks terrible and
Chips,
you know, somebody looks like Chips or the wrong director gets attached to it, like Michael Bay gets attached to it, and it's like, okay, it's got $150 million budget. And I say, fuck it, give it to the guys that did Dread.
Yeah.
They know how to do a film on no budget.
I will say, as much as we talked about the idea that it's bound to get some protest for just race stuff, given that it was an 80s action movie set almost exclusively in Chinatown, it really wasn't as nearly as racist as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Like, they did a really good job of kind of, like, it was all playing on stereotypes.
Yeah. But it's the way that you play on stereotypes. It's two white guys sitting here in an upstate New York room talking about this. But it's the way that you, like, playfully talk about race with your friends. Like,
yeah.
And not in a, not even in a, like, I can say the N-word because I got black friends.
Yeah.
But in a, like, you know, like... You know, my best, one of my best friends is Hispanic, and we have a back and forth, and
yeah,
and things like that. That's even the level. But even there, like, I don't believe Kurt Russell ever really makes any mention towards. It's just kind of that general tone that's a little off. But on the other hand, every Asian person in the film is actually Asian.
That's true.
You know,
they got one up on Marvel.
Yeah, they got one up on Ghost in the Shell, and they got one up on, you know, every remake of an Asian property for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting on whether they're able to do it, because that's one thing that, you know, John Carpenter on probably an $8 million budget could be like, screw you. I don't have to have people's name in it. You know, I don't have to, you know, get the guy from Karate Kid in it because it's, you know, or something, you know, it's like necessarily.
Although that is a thing that's worth, like, I am a white guy from upstate New York. Yeah. I couldn't necessarily tell you if every actor in here was actually Chinese American or if they were it's like, oh, half these guys were Japanese or Korean. And,
well, I mean, how bad the setup is in Hollywood and
yeah, that
the fact that they're Asian, I'll give it because it's also, you know. I mean, China. I mean, if you go to Chinatown, Chinatown's not just Chinese people wandering around.
It's true.
It's always that. It's kind of almost a racist term upon itself because, yeah. But it's really because I forget, was it Kurt Russell or I forget whether it was Kurt Russell or Batista was actually talking about in one of the interviews about how that was reading about how he actually saw the, I think it was Kurt Russell who saw the Asia, super bad that I forget the guy's name because he's actually really great. Dennis Dunn? No, it's not Dennis Dunn. But his co-star, has basically, he's the hero and Kurt Russell is basically completely the dupe. He's not, it's not like in, you know, to keep the metaphor going, it's not like in Die Hard where he's, you know, the black cop sitting down eating Twinkies, you know, that's the level of like race, you know, racial issues, but like, he's the guy that really genuinely saves the day. He's the guy that actually like gets anything done and heroically jumps into things. And Kurt Russell is kind of falling, tripping around, doesn't know how to shoot a gun, doesn't know how to do any of this stuff.
I'll say I would take it slightly less to the full extent than that and say that, like, he was basically the muscle.
Yeah.
Like, he was, like, the hired goon and the friend with the car and, like, the, you know, it was, like, the hero. Wang is a flawed hero who...
Yeah.
Doesn't have everything he needs to have in order to be heroic.
Yeah.
And so he kind of manipulates, like, a well-meaning idiot into... And actually, I wonder, depending on your reading of the script, I guess it's... You could argue that was the plan all along. Like, that from the moment when he went double or nothing and he... lost more money than he had on his person and now he needs to go get it. Like, maybe all of that, you know, maybe that was the reason he was really so pissed that Burton was going to walk away from the table, was that the whole time he needed Burton to come to the airport with him in case this happened.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But it's interesting. I was just reading it because the guy's name is Dennis Dunn and it's kind of sad. He's, he doesn't have even have a photo on, on IMDb, but he actually had no, which I was actually really surprised because usually the few times you have a leading role, it's Jet Li, it's Jackie Chan, people who have like actual martial arts training, and that's how they get the job. He didn't have any, according to IMDb, which is surprising considering, I mean, obviously there's probably stunts and everything and cutaways and things like that, but there's a certain level that he was on camera. And which it's amusing that on this, I have IMDb having a Guardian of the Galaxy Volume 2 advertisement
with
a little Groot trying to plug something in
at
the bottom. But
but yeah, the... God, yeah. I mean, it's funny because you watch this movie. I don't know. I feel like you have to be in the right headspace to really fall. Like, it's kind of like the Josie and the Pussycats movie that I love so much.
Yes.
Where it's like, you have to really get what they're...
How far do we make it in? 25 minutes almost? Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
I was just seeing how far we made it into an individual podcast without you mentioning it.
Well, I mean, if you can see behind you, there's a giant movie poster.
Yes, yes.
As well as a pair of prop ears hanging in the corner.
be sure to send that over, tag Rosario Dawson and be like,
yeah,
but tag it just like Zach is like super uncomfortable right now.
But it's got that same kind of feeling to it in terms of, I think that a lot of people, and now that it's like known as a classic and Carpenter is considered a master, and I think you probably don't get it as much as you would get with something like Josie and the Pussycats, but like, I feel like probably if I had watched this when I was 15, I'd have been like, this is fucking stupid. and I probably wouldn't have got, I feel like you have to be either a kid for whom it's like, wow, action.
Yeah.
Or you have to be old enough to be like, oh man, this is...
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that I could get my... I mean, not that I can get my 16-year-old sister to watch any films that I like, but yeah, I don't think I could get her to be interested in this film.
Yeah.
Which is sad. But, because it's too fantastic. But, yeah.
Too fantastic, too furious.
No. Well, which, again, he's in that too. Making the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon so easy these
days. I know.
But even though I can't...
That's what happens when Hollywood hires the same 8 people for every goddamn thing.
Well, that's what also happens when Marvel buys... Marvel or Disney buys Marvel, and then they just be like, we have no creative use. You know what? Don't worry. He's already one character in the film. We'll hire him to be a different actor, and he'll just voice one part and then do the other, because we have no creativity and we can't do it. But the DC films are the ones that suck.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Well, I mean, it's jarring how many fucking people are crossing over from Marvel to Star Wars and back.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like...
Well, no, I mean, we literally haven't... Like, we've done, like, 2 podcasts where either it's Marvel or Star Wars... and every single time, just even random bit players, you start going and crossing links, and it's like, I remember one actor.
Oh yeah, that guy who lives like near
had 14 roles in either Marvel or Star Wars films.
Yeah,
of the last, it's like, really.
To be fair, that was like an extra who lived near Pinewood.
Yeah, no, like, but it's still, it's really.
I guarantee he's probably in the Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes movies, too, because I think those shot there.
Yeah. But I mean, if nothing else, I it's good for him. He probably very easily can imagine him being on. He can go to Star Wars down in Orlando.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Just sign me like, here's my laundry list of films. I've been in more big action films than Harrison Ford has.
Yeah.
Which I did try to combine them, but he's probably one of the largest grossing action stars in the history of cinema, because he was in Guardians.
He was guy number two.
He was in Avengers. He was in Age of Ultron. He was it's like $14 billion block songs.
Yeah, I always love guys. Like, I love looking at stuff like that and being like, wait, he's just... And it's funny because it happens kind of at all levels until you get to the point where the person has enough screen time to be really recognizable.
Yeah.
Like, one of the random, and this is like a super well-known piece of trivia, but one of the random, like, hot girls who comes to flirt with Captain America in Captain America, the First Avenger, you wouldn't recognize her because she had no hair, but in Guardians of the Galaxy, she was Peter Quill's mom, who was dying of cancer. Yeah. Like, there was literally, like, there's a crazy fan theory that, like, oh, Peter Quill's mom was the same girl. It's like, no. No.
I mean, they're fun, but, like, yeah, no, no, no.
If he was 8 years old or whatever it was when he was kidnapped by aliens, then his mom wasn't 70 and giving birth to him. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, like, it is kind of crazy that, like, yeah, they do that all the way. Like, the fact that she has 2 different named characters in the Marvel Universe... Yeah. Actually, so does one of our favorite actresses, who's Alfre Woodard.
Yeah.
Alfre Woodard had a named character in Civil War, and then literally, like, within a month, was back shooting. I want to say it was season 2 of Daredevil or season 1 of Luke Cage, one of the two. And it's like, part of that is that those characters will never ever be in the movie. Like, don't let anybody tell you those characters are ever going to be in the movies or that it's all connected. It's not fucking all connected.
Yeah.
Shut up, Jeff Loeb. But, you know, the Netflix shows, the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. to a lesser extent because they've had some movie crossover, but that was before a corporate restructuring thing.
And them desperately trying to save the show.
but apparently it's like popular enough. Like, they're putting it at the 10 o'clock time slot means it's now the highest rated show in its time slot.
That's...
because basically the Marvel fans are following it to wherever it goes. Yeah. And so it's like, okay, all you got to do is put it in a time slot where nobody's fucking watching TV.
Yeah.
And those same 3 million people who have been watching it everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, now suddenly make it, and like, this is not like actually an assault on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which, like, if you like that show, fine. Like, it's not for me, but like, I certainly, I'm not one of those people who's like, fuck it, cancel it. And I'm not complaining that they're like cheating the system by making it the top rated show in a 10 o'clock Wednesday time slot or whatever the fuck it is. But it is like a wacky thing where you're just like, I got a press release and I was like, they said it was the top rated show on television in its time slot. I'm like, holy shit, really? And then you look and it's like, oh, the reason is because everything else in that time slot gets like 1.5 million people.
Yeah.
Like, it's the top rated show in its time slot by getting 1 million less people to watch it than watch The Flash on the CW. Like, okay, we're not really getting, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
but yeah, so back to the film.
Yeah, that was a weird sidetrack. Not that that those never happen on this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
But
and by the time we get the Guardian stuff in, and then whatever, it'll be like a 3-hour podcast. But that's fine.
The I'm trying to figure out what else we haven't covered. It was a
great movie. It was one of those movies where. First of all, it was, and we kind of alluded to this a couple times. It was one of those movies where nobody in it is really famous except for Kurt Russell, and so everybody in the movie, you see them, and you're like, I know that guy from The Thing!
I think Kim Cattrall was big.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Kim Cattrall.
No, I'm just trying to think. Fair. Even though she weirdly... She doesn't have as much role as you think she would have in the film, but...
Yeah.
But...
And I can't remember the woman's name who plays the vice president on Scandal, who's now like a right-wing talk show host... Which, as we all know, in the age of Trump, right-wing talk show hosts have more power than the actual president anyway. But she was, she's in it. She was the first vice president on Scandal. I can't remember her name. It's been a long time.
Kate Burton.
Yeah, Kate Burton.
Yeah.
And a lot of these guys, it's just like, you see so many of these actors in like 1 million different fucking things.
David Lee was in Avengers.
Or Donald Lee.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Donald Lee, yeah.
Who did he play in Big Trouble? What's the character's name? Like, he's the Lee. Wacky friend character. Yeah, Eddie.
Yeah.
He's the one who had a crush on the journalist character.
Yeah, Kate Burton.
Kate Burton's character.
And it actually should be noted. That none of, because now when I think about it, none of these characters play the stereotypical Asian.
Yeah.
None of them have, outside of,
they're, I mean, they're, it's
outside
that
of the bad guys and Victor Wong, who plays Egg Shen, the good magic guy.
Yeah.
the good guy with magic. And none of them play the thing, even to the point where Kurt Russell's Burton is in the elevator, and one of the random kind of like background characters who are in the ninja outfit. Mm-hmm. They cut to him, and she's like, "Can you?" Or I forget what it's like. You can you even understand this, or do you even speak English? And he goes, and he speaks in a straight like California accent, not even a just a standard accent.
Yeah.
And like Burton looks at him like weird, and so it's like it's actually interesting because it's like on its face. It's kind of super. It has definitely has some levels of racial overtones. But then when you actually kind of compact it, it's like, no, it actually is playing on all those things and doing it.
I think one of the things that I think could really work if you get the right director for this is the fact that it feels like. It feels like this is an homage to Hong Kong cinema of the 60s and 70s.
Many people have said, I think Carpenter have said that, and yeah, I mean, Carpenter's a big fan of that.
But the result of that is, like, this kind of movie didn't happen in the 80s. Like, this movie was kind of a weird animal all its own back then. Nowadays, this kind of thing is fairly common in terms of, like... stylistic homages and shit like that.
Yeah.
And so it's funny because that's one thing in terms of if you're looking forward to a reboot. And I don't mean anticipating a reboot. By looking forward, I just mean like if you're looking forward in time to the possibility of a reboot. Like this is the kind of movie they make now. It's not the kind of movie they made when they made it.
Yeah.
So it's actually in that way kind of ripe for a reinterpretation. Although I can't think of the last really good movie that did this kind of like style chameleon thing. I mean, I guess there's an argument to be made for La La Land, but I didn't like it.
I haven't seen it yet.
There was a whole podcast where we bagged on it, and I got super drunk and passed out, and like woke up as the other guys were leaving.
Russ, are you there?
No, I went to the bathroom and like just fell asleep on the toilet. And so like there's like on the podcast there's like and Russ is, and then everybody else is like, no, don't say it, don't say it. Anyway, Style Chameleon. Like there's an argument to be made for La La Land, but I didn't think it was that good.
Yeah.
But like you see it a lot on television.
Yep.
You see it a lot, like, you know, the Flash just did a musical episode that was like a throwback to 50s Hollywood. Yeah. You see like shows like Psych and Community that will take on like the war movie tropes for 1 week, or the, you know, the whatever.
Yeah.
To a lesser extent, you see something like Riverdale where like it's very clearly made to be like a noir movie.
Yeah, Brick.
Yeah, exactly.
Too, yeah.
That is a feature film version that
is worth
mentioning. We got to talk about that movie. Like, we got to do an episode with that movie one day soon because that's one.
We keep mentioning it's like Five for Fives and stuff like that, but never really really spend any time on it.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting because obviously, you know, it could go like, if you're gonna do a remake, it could definitely go like a Blade Runner way with the. You know, neon and everything like that. And, it'll be interesting because it's like there's a lot of Chinatown doesn't exist in kind of the cultural knowledge base the way that it used to.
Yeah,
like it used to be a very scary, mystical, you know, like at least whether it be in Hollywood cinema, but also just in I think general people's lives.
Yeah,
and also if you go to most. You know, major. If you go to San Francisco's Chinatown, it's a tourist location. Literally, it's basically a Disneyland version of Chinatown from 15 years ago. I mean, same thing with New York's Chinatown. Basically, is now like 80 blocks, square blocks of area. It's just kind of overtaken Little Italy. It's overtaken like everything, and it's like basically from
when my ex-girlfriend lived in Chinatown.
Oh my god! Yeah.
And it's like you would go the two blocks over to the Little Italy festival, and you could like walk through Little Italy and come out the other side still in Chinatown.
Yeah, Little Italy's like five blocks now,
yeah.
And it's literally, I think the only reason it's even that, it's because it's almost everything is some level of a cultural landmark so it's like, there's no way that restaurant is ever going to leave. Like, and probably like most places in Manhattan now, you know, most, the Mexican restaurants are run by, by some hipsters. The Chinese restaurants are actually staffed by Mexicans and, you know, so it's like no one actually runs their own. It's like, it's owned by somebody with a name that maybe used to have it, but
The last thing I definitely wanted to touch down on before we like wrap the Big Trouble in Little China portion is the structure of this movie. It's a thing we don't really see anymore, I don't think, because it was like, it's a lot of short bursts of action scenes interspersed with a lot of short bursts of, plot dump.
Yeah.
And nowadays I feel like movies are made where you have long stretches of plot and then like giant action set pieces. Yeah. And, you know, the thing that I can think of that functions like this nowadays are all like comedies.
Yeah.
Like, think of whatever that terrible Robert Downey Jr. remake of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was. I think it was Due Date.
Oh my god, yeah. Yeah.
That had this kind of similar vibe where it was like, you're getting in a car, driving to a place, a thing happens. Get in the car, drive to a place, a thing happens.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm going through, most of Carpenter's films are like this.
Yeah, well, that's...
And whether or not, I almost feel like it's very much set up for television. Mm-hmm. Like, it's almost like, and I don't know if that it would even possibly be a reason. I mean, I guess the only, you know, because, you know, when he was making his big films, these films, or his, you know, films that have lasted, and he was, you know, really prominent, the only outlet really was, you know, VHS stores weren't really around.
Yeah, no, not at all. The video stores weren't really, it was kind of like, you were making it for the theatrical audience and then for TV syndication.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, even there. And you know, I mean, all these...
I mean, I do think by the... This is 1986. So, by the time 86 rolled around, this was probably a movie that he knew was going to be seen in video stores and stuff because, like so many things in cinema, I feel like it was the double hit of Star Wars and Jaws that suddenly made it like, okay, well, we need video, like we need a different way for people. People want to own this.
Yeah.
And so I think by the time the Star Wars trilogy was done, video stores were starting to be a thing. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's kind of a, but yeah, it's, you're absolutely right that Carpenter does it all the time. I also think it was super common in the '80s, both in action movies. And when you look back at like, I mean, I use the example of Due Date, which is very much a throwback to like John Hughes style comedies of the, you know, the Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and the Vacations and things like that. That even you look at a Vacation now, the one that they did with Chris Hemsworth, and it's a totally different structure and a totally different movie with raunchier jokes and,
well,
you know.
Well, I mean, you had, I mean, the '80s, I think we probably touched upon this before, I'm trying to remember what podcast, which one we were talking about, but that there's very few, like, $40 million action films anymore.
Yeah.
It's either enormous or maybe a gritty, low-budget, you know...
Yeah, oh yeah.
Single guy running, you know, like whatever the modern... I'm trying to think of 16 Blocks with Bruce Willis, or, you know, where it's just like, it's low-budget, in quotes, you know?
Yeah.
You know, $25 million. Oh, we did this on a low-budget, $25 million. Yeah, 10 of that went to Bruce Willis.
And, yeah.
But,
it's... And then he was a dick to everybody.
Yeah. Well. But you don't see these as often, and that because I think, and a lot of it is the fact that, like, you know, I mean, how long was Batman versus Superman?
Yeah, it's like two hours and 48 minutes or
something. Yeah, it's so rare, other than maybe Michael Bay films, and even Michael Bay films. I think the last Transformers was 2 hours.
Yeah.
Like, God forbid. But you know, I mean, like, everything has gotten so much longer. And what was this, probably an hour and a half?
96 or 8 minutes, because we actually, like, we were trying to watch it before my kid got home,
it's interesting that we don't, you know, you don't have the short action. I mean, I think Dread is a kind of an example.
Yeah, Dread was super compact. It was somewhere in the 90 to 100 minutes,
which is perfect. I mean, like, this film was another 10 minutes, and I think it would be too long.
I feel like low budget,
the same one too.
I feel like that the handful of low budget movies and low budget studios that you get, you're starting to see these kind of make a little bit of a comeback, and I think the idea behind that, honestly, is simply that if it's short, you can fit one more screening in.
Yeah.
So, like, I guess, that makes movies sense, that are only going to have one or two weekends before they're gone.
Yeah.
It's like the Belko Experiment or Slight, which are both from Blumhouse Tilt, where they make movies for $1 million bucks. And you know, a little bit more than that, but those are both like in the neighborhood of 90 to 100 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I feel like both of those movies are things that if you don't see them the opening weekend, you might catch it on the second or third, maybe. And then if you want to buy it on Blu-ray, it's going to be like $40 because they make a small print run.
Yeah.
And so, like, I genuinely, like, when you're looking at considerations like that, where it's like, oh, if I want to get Belko on Blu-ray, it's $40. Because there was a tiny print run, and they don't expect it to sell that many copies. They think people are probably going to buy it digitally or whatever, mm-hmm. or bootleg it.
Yeah.
When you get down to that level of consideration, I feel like that's got to be part of it. Is like, look, if your movie's 2 hours, then that means we can show it two fewer times than a 90-minute movie in opening weekend.
Yeah. I mean, also, I mean, just in general, probably shorter, you know, shooting times and stuff like
that. Yeah, oh yeah.
You don't have to have, especially if you have a name actor of some level, you can... You know, you'd be like, oh, I only need you for 3 weeks. We don't need you for, like, the 3 months that a two-and-a-half-hour action film takes and, you know, and everything like that. But it should be noted before we go, because before we end this portion of the podcast, is that the writer of Big Trouble, one of the writers of Big Trouble in Little China, also did Navy SEALs.
Ooh.
He also did Total Recall. So this guy, you know, he has a trilogy.
Yeah, for a while there, he was pretty...
1990 was a good year for him. Navy SEALs and Total Recall, and then 86. Surprisingly, only did three, and his last one was Next with Nick Cage, which was
I remember that, like, right at the tail end of my time at the video store.
It's on Netflix now. If anyone catches it, you know, get really drunk, and it's not one of Nick Cage's, like, so bad it's good campy ones, like Drive. What was it? Drive Angry.
Drive Angry.
Which I love.
Isn't that just favorite. A movie that everybody saw because they were like, "Holy shit, Amber Heard is gorgeous," and that was pretty much. I feel like that was the promotional campaign. Like, I remember a movie poster that was just like her, looking at the car from the perspective of, like, essentially looking up her leg.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And also, it was basically the film that Ghost Rider should have been.
Yeah,
because it was basically, he literally played, like, the story of Ghost Rider. He had, like, except he didn't have a motorcycle; he had a car.
You watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Ghost Rider does have a car.
Yeah. Got to sell those Matchbox cars.
Man. All right. Well, any final thoughts on Big Trouble in Little China?
If you haven't seen it, dear Lord, man, it's on Netflix. You got to go see it. You got to see it. Buy it. Do everything with it because the film's awesome. And you should definitely see it before any, God forbid, remake happens so that we can all be saddened when The Rock, who, again, I love The Rock.
Yeah.
I actually really like him. I'm a huge Fast and Furious fan, and I think he's actually one of the better kind of big action star actors that are around.
Yeah, we were talking just before we got on here that, like, he has that, like, complete package thing of, like, he's funny and he's charming and he's able to do the physical, like, both the stunts and the humor.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's really nothing wrong with him. It's just the fact that the archetype that's represented by the Jack Burton type of character is not one that, like, we were talking about that CIA movie where The Rock tried to play, like, kind of a dumber guy who, I can't remember what the whole shtick was, but I remember he was, like, a loser in high school. And
it's just... Yeah.
And it's like, you see him, like, super enthusiastic and raring to go, and he's, you know, and it's just like, no, you're not believable, because, like, it doesn't matter how big you smile and how friendly you act. Like, that was the whole shtick of that movie, The Pacifier, he did.
Oh, yeah.
Is that, like, no matter how friendly you act, no matter how cute you are, you're still the fucking Rock. And every place you walk in, people are going to be intimidated.
And the problem is that clearly he was trying earlier on, I think, and maybe he's still trying to do it a little bit now. He's trying to go the Arnold Schwarzenegger route with doing the Kindergarten Cop and stuff like that.
True.
And that worked for him because the films were written for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Like the jokes, like it's not a tumor.
You know,
that joke couldn't.
It literally wouldn't
work.
The Rock
couldn't do
it
with anybody else. Like, who else could do that? You know. So, and also, the big thing for me is that, like, in this film, that half the bit is that there's these, you know, small, you know, like, relatively not, they're not enormous, Chinese, Asian, whatever guys that are fighting him, and he's intimidated by, he's getting his ass kicked by them because he's just a guy who, it, you know, maybe he's done some bar fights.
Yeah.
But The Rock walks in there with, you know,
with,
you know, muscles everywhere. Yeah. And that's a different scene.
Yeah, exactly.
So unless he decides to, like,
again,
bulk
it
down.
we talked about this while the movie was on, that I kind of feel like the way to make this a thing that could work as a reboot.
Yeah.
Is to, like, embrace the kind of girl power movement that's going on in cinema. And, like it's a whole different thing if it's, like, The Rock getting his ass kicked by a girl.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but, I mean, the problem is that kind of requires him, like you were saying, it's like it requires him to dumb down a little bit. And what the good thing about him is that that's his bit is he's, everybody thinks he's, like, just a dumb big guy.
Right.
But then he's usually pretty intelligent in his films. I mean, he's... You know, been able to go up against everybody, and you know, in the Fast and Furious series, which isn't really saying a lot, but you know, but he's the FBI agent, and all the other guy, he's the smart FBI agent, and all the other guys are the dumb car jocks, and or whatever. But and so it's just it's problematic because I think it's just the wrong casting.
No, I do too. And like I said, I do think that you can make it work. I think that you would have to. I think that you would have to do the Ghostbusters thing and kind of embrace the fact that we're not going to make the same movie.
But it's, like, I mean, the problem is it's such an uphill battle. You know, absolutely. Ghostbusters, they didn't change much.
Yeah.
And look what happened there, yeah. You know, and they didn't change a lot. And obviously, much, you know, 80% of that was the stupid, you know, just, God, how dare you ruin my childhood by, yeah. you know, daring to think that people exist other than white males yeah. in cinema, in theaters now. But a lot of, you know, but a lot of it was, you know, somewhat well-deserved, where it's like, why do you change, why are you fucking with a trope that already works? Like, yeah. just little things that they did, you know, with, like, the choosing of actors. Like, I was always like, I think we had this discussion with Ghostbusters, maybe, where it's just like, why is Megan, what's her name, playing the Bill Murray role? I'm sure, they were all kind of playing the wrong roles, I felt. For whoever, Kate,
McKinnon. McKinnon was perfect.
That worked, but everybody else was like, what?
Yeah, I mean, part of that, too, and I think we talked about this at the time, that from what I heard, Melissa McCarthy was originally supposed to play the character that Leslie Jones played. Yeah. Is it Leslie Jones?
Yeah.
But that, for whatever reason, she changed her mind, and it's like, it would have been uninspired because it would have been just another one of that character for Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it would have been Melissa McCarthy playing to type.
Yeah.
And so it would have been a little bit less of a stretch for her.
Yeah.
And if Leslie Jones had literally any other part in the movie, it wouldn't have been so racist.
Yeah.
So that, like, you're definitely right. That, like, one of the weaknesses of Ghostbusters, I won't say it was the casting, because they're all very funny people.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that it was the fact that the characters didn't seem to be written for those actors, which is fucking bizarre when you consider that you know the characters were written for those actors.
Yeah, yeah, and considering you know that probably at least a portion of the film was improvised, considering all of them are improv or SNL or equivalent actors, so that they have, you know, I mean, so, I mean, again, that film was, I still like the film.
Yeah,
but it was the thing where it's like, it was so close to being as good as the original, which always pisses me off because it, anytime they do those switches, then the crowd of, you know, haters get to say, look at it, only made so much money and look at it, how terrible it was. And it's like, well, no, it was just any other film that, you know, they fucked up the casting or they fucked up the, you know, like some of it, you know.
Here's the thing. You look at the box office of that movie, you look at what it cost, you look at all the variables, and it's like, if it was anything except for Ghostbusters, I think that it would have been considered a hit.
Yeah.
Like, if it wasn't a big franchise, and particularly a big franchise they were trying to revive, then it would have been considered, like, it made money that was similar to, like, what Spy made.
Yeah.
Spy wasn't considered a huge hit, but it was certainly, like, the studio was happy with it.
Yeah.
And that was the same director, the same star, you know. speaking to the Big Trouble in Little China remake, I kind of hope that it falls apart before it happens.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't, like, I do think there's a version of it that could work.
Yeah.
I agree with you. It's definitely an uphill battle.
Yeah.
But I think there is a version that works. It's just a question of, like,
I mean, finding hell, it. The film that we're comparing this to is Guardians of the Galaxy. I mean, we were talking about this before. Who in the hell, 6 years ago, ever could have possibly imagined that we'd literally... I'm getting pop-up ads for Groot.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, like, the fact that I can say I am Groot to my 16-year-old sister who doesn't read comic books, doesn't like anything, and she loves it, and she has her own talking Groot on her on her desk at home, like, anything can happen.
it really, I mean, that's the Guardians thing, and we'll probably get into this more when we're talking about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, but the Guardian, like, it's... As a comic book guy, these are characters that I've always liked. Mm-hmm. This is a take on the team. I mean, plus minus, because obviously Gunn very much ran the Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning team through his filter.
Yeah.
But, like, the Abnett and Lanning run is what inspired this take on the movies, and I loved that run when it was coming out. I was working at a comic shop. But it's like, if you had told me, even at that time when Iron Man was in theaters, that, like, oh, yeah... This is the Iron Man thing is going to work so well that in a few years they're going to make a fucking movie based on Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning's Guardians of the Galaxy run. Good luck with that.
We had Iron Man 2 and 3. And I'm not surprised that when Iron Man came out, I was like, really? Iron Man is the start they're starting with? Not, you know, obviously, you know, with Spider-Man, and that's the sadness is that you know, their biggest properties really are kind of elsewhere.
Yeah.
And no one can, I guess no one at all can figure out how to make Fantastic Four ever work. So, but anyway.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will be back. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, the conclusion.
Dun-dun-dun.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Mike. I'm trailing.
Man, it sure is great to be back to FCTC after such a long time.
Yes, it is, and we've been away so long.
Yeah, but real life and... you know what? I just can't do this.
Can't do what?
We have taken more breaks from this show than my wife has had in her entire life. I mean, we can talk about real life getting in the way.
Which it has.
But it's just not fair. So we're not going to joke around, and we're going to simply say that for the moment, we're back, and there's a lot of neat stuff to talk about.
Like season 2 of Lois and Clark.
And the death of Clark Kent.
And the launch of Superman the Man of Tomorrow.
And the return of Lex Luthor.
And the trial of Superman.
And Underworld Unleashed.
The show can still be found at the Superman homepage, as well as at the Fortress of Baileytude.
And we're still part of the Superman Podcast Network.
So From Crisis to Crisis is back.
For now.
And it will still come out on Thursdays.
Most week at www.fortressofbaileytude.com, www.supermanhomepage.com, or www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
Peter Quill, the main character of Guardians of the Galaxy, or the kind of point of view character anyway, is very much, and I won't say derivative of Jack Burton, but there's clearly some shared DNA there, which is something that they made explicit in this movie.
Yeah, quite so. and if even not just Jack Burton, but like kind of Kurt Russell's characters of that era, whether it be Snake Plissken and, you know, I mean, obviously Snake Plissken a lot less than I'd say Jack Burton, just because of the, you know, the lack of, I don't know, the lack of direct criminality that Snake Plissken implies, and a little bit less care for human beings. You know, Jack Burton clearly has a care for humans, even though the premise of the film is he's just sticking along for his money and then for the girl, but not really.
Yeah. It, well, I mean, he's kind of a, it's just like the he's kind of a douche instead of an actual criminal.
Yes. Yep.
Which I feel like kind of a douche is one of those things that got said a lot in this movie.
Yeah.
So, I mean, going into Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, Guardians of the Galaxy is far and away my favorite of the Marvel movies. You and I have talked a lot about in the past how Marvel's formula, like, they make really enjoyable movies that typically you can watch like once or twice, because after that you're just like, oh yeah, it's this one again.
Yeah.
The original Guardians has a ton of rewatchability, and it was a really high bar, I think. And you see this reflected, I think, in some of the, there haven't really been bad reviews, but some of the kind of middling reviews for the new movie all kind of say, yeah, they don't really do anything new, and it's more of the same, which, first of all, I would disagree with.
Yeah.
But secondly, it's that's indicative mostly of this idea that they're holding it to the standard of the original film.
Yeah.
Which is a difficult thing to do, and I think that this one really stands up in a surprising way.
Oh yeah, I mean it does something that so many of, I would say, the Marvel films don't really do, which is genuinely further the characters beyond just creating new conflicts for them. Because, right. I mean, like, I don't feel like beyond maybe Iron Man 2, I don't feel like Robert Downey Jr.'s character has evolved in any way, shape, and form, other than just in Civil War, I suddenly hate you. And there's kind of like outside factors coming in that change it dramatically but it seems to happen off camera. There's certainly an evolution here with like Gamora and Star-Lord and that, you know, there's a love interest happening that seems to actually be evolving, like the Galaxy of Guardians of the Galaxy family, like as they continually refer to themselves, you know, is becoming more and more of a family. Rocket's character seems to have really, really evolved in from being like a fun little furry animal that runs around to like this film really established him as kind of an individual, which is good because he's kind of one of those, he's a machination of a scientist, you know, and he can very easily just be a clone or a character or whatever, and just a fun, and he could very easily, you could very easily make a film with half of these characters that is literally just, well, these are really fun characters. It's a raccoon that runs around and holds big guns, and it would be fun, and it would be fun as hell. But, you know, I mean, there's moments where, you know, Rocket blanking on the guy with the arrow.
Oh, Yondu.
Yes, sorry, Yondu. And Yondu's character have that really, really great scene. And, you know, it's a little bit spoilerish, but I'll just generally say a really great scene together where they talk about how the connection that they have. And, mm-hmm. I mean, and also Yondu's character, who went from a moderately – not evil, but just non-care. I don't know. I don't know what he was in the first film. Like, I was surprised at how much I really wanted him to stick around for a third film. And I mean, speaking of the, like, kind of the setup at the end, I mean, like, I really enjoy, too, is that they did it in such a great way that it's not the cut cliffhanger sort of way. And they did it in the, like, we're not about to, you know, we're about to go on this next adventure, but they clearly set up the film in a way that clearly there's going to be a third one. Obviously they started the film, like they ended the film with Guardians of the Galaxy will be seen again, you know.
Yeah, we'll return.
Although
they're going to be in, it's interesting because this movie, like just from a behind the scenes kind of perspective, the filmmakers have said this movie takes place 4 months, I think it is, after the first movie. Mm-hmm. So this didn't unfold in real time. Yeah. 2-year-old Groot is really 4-month-old Groot, which tells you kind of a little bit about how he ages.
Yeah.
And little things like that. Yeah. But the next movie is going to take place after the events of Avengers Infinity War.
Yeah.
And so when we see them again, the Guardians are going to be much farther along the line between 2 and 3 than they were between 1 and 2.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how a lot of that stuff kind of shakes out. Cause again, like all of the changes in evolution that we saw was basically from them being strapped together inside of a rocket for 4 months.
Yeah.
now that it's going to be 4 years or whatever it is, when we see them again, I imagine that's going to be a very, very different kind of dynamic that's going on. I don't think this is the kind of filmmaker who's going to ignore that and not kind of adjust their level of evolution appropriately.
Yeah. No, I can certainly say, I mean, especially if the rumors you were talking about before are true that Gunn is going to take over kind of as a showrunner of the whole universe.
I don't know if that's rumors so much as it was just my interpretation of like what they've been saying about.
Now that you've said it, it's a rumor. Come on, man. That's how the entertainment industry works. You just need one person saying it. Now it's a whisper. Oh, there's whispers about.
Exactly. Like it's been said on this podcast, so now anybody can quote this podcast and blame me if they're wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, if that is true, which the fact that all the big characters, the big directors and big producers of Marvel have kind of, you know, you've seen them fade or move away and they're being replaced with other people. Gunn, clearly, if this film doesn't open with blockbuster numbers, I'll be really surprised.
It's supposed to make like $150 million this weekend.
Yeah, so I mean, like, if you're not going to give it to the single-handedly most kind of unbelievably, like, if Gunn can do this with Guardians of the Galaxy, can you imagine what he can do with the Avengers? You know, right. I mean, so like, I think they'd be. I mean, not that you know, Marvel or DC for that matter are, you know, completely brilliant when it comes to the kind of overall show running, you know, atmosphere.
But I think the thing that'll be really interesting, if that's the case, and if Gunn does step into a more kind of organizational role, helping them find the direction of the Marvel universe, is finding out how that looks. Because when I spoke to him back during the home video release for Guardians 1, you know, one of the reasons he said he doesn't want to do an Avengers movie, he doesn't want to do a Star Wars movie. Like, he wants to make movies where he can shape the universe.
Yeah, yeah.
And where, like, the movie looks and feels like a movie that he wants to make.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, with Guardians, he had the opportunity to build his own everything, his own aesthetic. And then the reason that Thor looks like Guardians isn't because Gunn was taking copious notes from Marvel on how to do space. It was because Guardians did so well that now looks like.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see. You know, they set up a lot. They set up, there were 5 post-credit sequences. Some of them were just silly, but some of them set up. I mean, if you are a person who reads the comics, you know what a couple of those things mean. Certainly, it's pretty obvious that the one involving Aisha, which was one of the – there were essentially 2 villains in this film. There was Aisha, and then there was Ego. Yeah. And Aisha was the kind of mustache-twirling villain who we got from the very beginning, and you know she's bad. And then Ego is the more kind of sweet-talking villain who it takes you a while to figure out what his deal is.
Yeah.
Ordinarily, like if I was doing a totally non-spoiler thing, I would be really hard pressed to figure out how to talk about Ego, actually, because like it's like halfway through the movie when you finally accept, okay, yeah, he really is the bad guy.
Yeah.
But the other side of that is he's been referred to as the villain basically since he was cast, and so it's that weird thing of like, oh, are we going to go with the movie going experience, or are we going to go with what literally anybody who cares about the film knows?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm literally, because I was double checking a name on something, and Miley Cyrus did a voice for the film. She was the computer system. Interesting. Anyway, I don't want to distract that, but it was just
I'm sure Rob Zombie did too, because Rob Zombie is friends with Gunn, and he's a voice in everything.
Yeah, it's just, well, Seth Green did Howard the Duck, so.
Yeah, he was Howard the Duck last time.
Yeah, oh, that's true. Yeah.
Uncredited that time around because in that post credit sequence, they didn't want to put him in the credits in case people would notice it in the credits and have the post credit sequence blown.
Yeah. I'm curious, not to distract it completely towards cast, you know, like cat, just weird cast details, is how did Vin Diesel do the voice for this one? whether he actually did do, you know, like, I am Groot.
Yeah.
Or whether they did some digital effect on it, because that's something I actually really want to know.
I'm sure that's out there. I'm sure that was the first question somebody asked.
Because also, I won't get into the post credit sequence with Groot, but also that. There's also that, which was also kind of hilarious.
Like I said, I was surprised by how much I liked Baby Groot throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Because it really, like, one of the things that I was kind of, as I was watching the trailers and stuff, I was like, man, that has the risk of wearing thin real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
And they did a surprisingly good job of not doing that. I think honestly.
Go ahead.
Sorry? Yeah. I was going to say, part of it, honestly, I think, is because the scene that feels like, oh man, that has the risk of wearing thin the most was the thing with the detonator.
Yeah.
And that was the very first thing that we all saw in that first trailer. Yeah. But it happens with like 10 minutes left in the movie or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you're just sitting here going, that is a... like the part where you're just like, okay, now we've reached peak Baby Groot. We need to dial it back a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
The impression we kind of got was that it was going to be in that first act, like when they were fighting the giant squid monster thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And instead, in the final act, when they're having like the climactic battle.
Yeah.
And so it was a totally different kind of experience viewing that scene in context than it was viewing it in the ads.
Yeah, no, I'm generally surprised that he didn't turn out to be like the little kid in the film or in the action film or the pup or the dog where you're like, oh my God, is he going to get squished? There was those moments. But I mean, like, dear Lord, all that went out the window in that opening sequence, which was
probably definitely one of the best, I'm trying to figure out how to describe it, but one of the best like action sequences with a comical, it definitely had a, it wasn't a serious action sequence. You didn't necessarily, like, obviously it's the first 5 minutes of the film. So you're not like, oh my God, someone's going to die. Like,
yeah,
it's not that sort of franchise.
Yeah. I mean, that scene was the corollary, obviously, to the scene where Star-Lord was first finding the Infinity Gem in the first movie, where he's dancing around and he's singing and he's kicking the rat things and all that kind of stuff.
Which, by the way, fantastically have a like a large role in this film.
but they come back like six times in this movie.
But anyway, but what was the – we actually both looked at each other during one of the scenes when they looked at each other. I don't think we mentioned it yet. When Star-Lord what he says, you're like, I'm Star-Lord. Who? Like, there's actually another corollary.
Yeah, there was a scene in Big Trouble in Little China where. Yeah. We did talk about that. Lopan.
I mean, in the in Guardians, there was a scene where was it Ego who said, "Well, yeah. I've heard the antics or heard the stories of whatever."
Yeah.
And there's a cut to where he's like, "Yeah,
yeah," where he's like,
"But that's something."
Yeah.
I feel like obviously there's that 4 month gap. I mean, it could have that between the two films. But I really do enjoy on how much evolved the characters have kind of clearly been. The fact that now that they're famous to some level for being the Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, I mean, and the fact that they, I don't know, the fact that they don't play on it so much that there's no Star Wars celebration scene like at the end of the first trilogy where like they go and march, but there is like, you know, a Rocket has the one-off line. You're like, oh, if we save the galaxy twice, we'll be able to double our fee, or you know, be able to up our fees. And it keeps so much of the kind of the rebel spirit, kind of the outside. These people aren't Superman, Batman, Aquaman. You know, any of the known trilogy. You know, Wonder Woman, unknown trilogy of like being above everything. They still have, you know, still have all the jokes and still have everything. And you know.
Yeah, and I will say I think one of the things they did even better this time around than they did the first time was integrating the pop culture elements of it.
Yeah.
You know, because at the end of the day, even though he's like 34 years old or 40 years, or yeah, 33 years old, I guess, in continuity, because we saw 34 years later was a title card that popped right after Ego impregnated Meredith.
Yeah.
Even though it's, you know, he's 30 odd years old, this is still a dude who left his home world when he was like 10 or whatever it was. And so basically all of his formative experiences are through like the prism of pop culture.
Yeah.
And so I told my wife almost nothing about the movie because she really loved the first one and wants to go see this. But the thing that I told her, because it amuses me more than anything else, was this is $180 million superhero blockbuster action movie.
Yeah.
And there's a scene in which someone yells out the line, "I don't know what Cheers is."
Yes, I know. And like, it's one of those films where I go, I'm watching this as a sequel to a massive blockbuster film that I was perplexed as you were that it was so big and that it got made. I think half of our conversation after the film was the fact, I mean, like, how did this happen? Like, how are we where we are now? We're having these conversations, you know? I mean, like, obviously, you know, it's fantastic. We're getting films like Black Panther and we're getting films like, you know, like we're finally getting a Wonder Woman film. We're getting a film that has a starring woman in it. Holy fucking shit. Like, for an action film, that's fucking unheard of. But still, this film perplexes me, not necessarily because, oh yeah, it's a bunch of, you know, a bunch of white guys voicing shit. Well, I'm sorry, Saldana is obviously not white, but you know,
and Vin Diesel's whatever Vin Diesel is.
Vin Diesel is the mixed bag of of fantasticness. I love Vin Diesel, so but it is, this film perpetuates the how in hell does this film continue? I mean, there wasn't just a one off line about Cheers; it was a running
runner.
It was a running line. And the fact that like the demo that they're clearly going after is younger than Cheers.
Yeah, it's like people born after that show was canceled.
You know what? That's what it is. That's what I think is so fantastic about these two films is that they're not kids films per se, but they're all ages films. I mean, like I was, you know, somebody was saying, it's like, oh, you think it'd be okay with for my 4-year-old to come in the film? And I'm like, well, if they like, I think Jeff from comic book store was saying this. He's like, you know, well, if they like the first one, I don't think it would be a problem if they were able to live through it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's some intensity to the action, but.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a really loud film, so it might be too intense on that end. But my big thing was, holy crap, like this is like what our age animated stuff was, like Animaniacs and stuff like that. There's a lot of fun. Like if you're 7, you watch Animaniacs, it's awesome, it's hilarious, it's fantastic, it's goofy, it's whatever. You watch it at 14, there's another layer, and then you watch it at like 30, there's a whole nother layer. You know, I mean, and that's what I think is like makes this film clearly able to be the massive blockbuster that, I mean, I hope this thing breaks a billion. It would be fucking fantastic if it did, because I think it well deserves it. I don't want to diminish the first one at all because it's fantastic, but I think that this one is better. It took all of the, it's better, but it also wouldn't be able to be better without the first one, if that makes sense.
Right. You know? I think that's the thing. It's very much, when you look at superhero movies, when you look at movies, sequels tend to deliver diminishing returns.
Yeah.
Unless you get super lucky and you have like The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
I think this falls into that Empire Strikes Back mold. And in the same way that like The Empire Strikes Back wouldn't be nearly as effective without Star Wars, because like who gives a shit who his dad is if you don't know like why that's important.
Yeah.
All of that, including the dad thing, applies here.
Yeah.
Before I go downstairs, which I got to do in like a minute, so we'll wrap up the Guardians half of this episode a little earlier. But one thing I did want to talk about just briefly was the visual effects.
Oh my god!
Because the effects in this movie were fantastic. Oh, we saw it in 2D. There were some things that clearly were meant for 3D because you could just see the kind of green screening effect almost. Yeah. But the thing that struck me the most, because we're discussing this alongside Big Trouble in Little China, was the scene where Yondu and Rocket fly to the rescue of Peter when they're flying to Ego.
Yeah.
And without getting into too many spoilery details, there's animation that happens during that flight that's just crazy. It looks like the characters were all put through some like crazy filter on a YouTube video.
It reminds me
of
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy when they did the jumps.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And it worked well in that film because of the context of the film, and it works fucking fantastically in this film. I mean, I will say, like, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen it yet, which what the hell, like, you just spoiled yourself, like, what's going on? But go see it. Like, we were lucky enough, we saw it in a really great theater called this Movie Tavern. They have a massive screen and it's not like obstructed, you know, it's not got like some guy's head in front of you like when you're sitting in most like New York City theaters. Go see this in IMAX. I'm gonna go see it in IMAX or whatever the hell else. I assume it's an IMAX. I'm gonna go see it next time. I gotta bring my sister to it. She actually yelled at me that I went without her.
And we had Dave's ticket.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. I should have just picked her up. But anyway, 1 o'clock on a school night, which I don't know, she goes to
school.
Anyway, but you know, go see it at a really great theater if you can, because the sound is amazing. The special effects. I mean, they talked about Ego's world as like one of the biggest things ever. Oh my god! I mean, Ego's world is unbelievable. I mean, the special effects on it. Yeah. It's not like uber real. It's not like oh, this is a real place. But it's a fully realized planet. Which, you know, obviously should be, but it's a fully realized thing. And it's like, Sean Gunn, or Sean Gunn, fantastic. Yeah, no. Yeah, I should not discredit Gunn. But the guns, I'll say the guns, they went into this film blazing. fully loaded. Yes. I can't possibly recommend this film enough. For it's one of those few things where it's like, you know, we always put caveats on Batman versus Superman, and there's different things. So it's like, well, you got to accept this. Literally, I can't think of a human being on this planet that shouldn't go see this film. And if you don't enjoy it, I don't know what kind of person you are. Like, I want to like kind of dissect your humanity if you don't enjoy this film at some level. Like,
I'm going to make a custom movie poster that has that quote on.
Yes. I should actually tweet it out. James Gunn just liked one of my other tweets about the film. So he'd be like, I don't know what kind of horrible human being you are if you don't like this film. It might be a little too long for a quote, though.
I'm in full agreement. Like I said, I love pairing these two movies together because it works really well on a bunch of levels because of the casting thing and the tonal thing, and then like when I was watching that scene where the crazy jump thing, where they were mutilating the characters' faces essentially with the computers. Mm-hmm. I was just like, man, this feels like the way that a Big Trouble in Little China remake could work with computers.
Could we get James Gunn, if you're out there, if you're listening, that'd be awesome if you're listening, by the way. But if you're listening, can you somehow just be like, no, I need to do that film. I need to do film. I don't care who you cast then. If James Gunn does Big Trouble in Little China, it can be The Rock. I don't care. He'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of the magic, like any other director that you kind of throw this out to, you describe this film. I mean, especially with the first one, but even more so with, you know, kind of doubling down with the sequel. Because I was very, very worried about how this film was going to be. And I apologize to Gunn. I should not have been. I dare doubt your majesty, because this film, I have a hard time describing on how much fun I had watching this film and how much I needed it too.
It's really like the perfect movie for this horrible, horrible moment in time.
Yes, yes. Yes, it is.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Emerald City Video Podcast. I'm going to go take care of children who are not little trees.
now it sounds like you're threatening them.
Well.
I'm going to go take care of some children.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
In these times of hardship, just remember, we are Groot.
I think the thing that I really liked in that third act is that you have the big character death.
Yeah.
But it's not the typical superhero event comic or superhero movie character death where it's done essentially for shock value and like it made organic sense. And actually early in the film, they planted the seed, essentially that not only did the death mean something in the way that it was done, but also, the events that took place in the last 5-6 minutes of the movie, which normally would just be kind of setting up for the sequel, mm-hmm. had character-driven organic meaning.
Yeah.